I started off being very crabby with my husband for giving this to me because I'm like, what? Yes. Yes, because he gave me two verses. I'm like, oh, really? Plus, I had a very busy week. But God was amazing. He was really gracious. So you can start now, Pete. Thanks. Okay. So, this is what we are doing. Andy, I always forget which arrow it is and which way round it is.
The one nearest the light button.
One nearest the light button.
That's
it. There we go. Good. So, I'm not going to read loads of scriptures. The references are in there, but it would take too long. But I just did. I'm doing a bit of recap of the whole series. So, the because we're looking at both passages in the Bible and words that have been brought to us about reopening wells. And this was the verses that I was given. So I will read them. This is Genesis 26, verse 19 to 21. Isaac's servants dug in the valley and discovered a well of fresh water there. But the herders of Gerar quarreled with those of Isaac and said, "The water is ours." So he named that well Esek because they disputed with him. Then they dug another well, but they quarreled over that one as well. So he named it Sitnah. And you've got a bit more, that's in red, you've got a bit more above that in blue, which was covered last week and in the introduction. But that's up there as a reminder. This is the context. And then we've referred to the word that Mark Birch Machin brought us on the 12th of the 11th, 16, almost exactly 7 years ago. And he said, in respect of this passage, okay, there might have been a bit of quarrelling. Well, that happened in Genesis 26 and turned out all right, didn't it? In the Bible, it ended well. So don't be put off by a bit of quarrelling. And then he goes on to say how it ended well. Jacob, Israel, the tribes, the multitude. I'll make you into a great nation. I'll bless you. I'll make your name great. You will be a blessing. I will bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. So basically, Mark was saying there, bit of quarrelling doesn't get in the way of God and what he's doing. I nicked Andy's maps that he had the other week because they're really useful for figuring out the area we're talking about. So you can see on here, the first, so he started off at Gerar, you can see that. I haven't got a point. You can see Gerar. It's just inside the red bit. If you go southeast of that, you get Esek, which was the next one I mentioned. And then you get Sitnah. So he's, and you can see we've got the Mediterranean up there and a seaplain, which is always fertile because it's well watered. And then you can see the mountains up against the back. So Isaac's increasingly moving towards the mountains. And in the next talk, we're going to hear about Rehoboth, which is the last well that was dug around the area of Beersheba, which was the next one on. And that's even further in. So just a quick recap of what I've understood so far. And because we've had two very long talks, I'm really talking about quick recap. You know, this is what I got from it. You might have got other stuff, and this isn't everything that I got even. To me, what I understood by reading in the wells was that you're accessing an existing known or forgotten supply. God's stored provision for us. He wants us to find and use the treasure stored away by our predecessors, like a squirrel going back to hidden acorns. Incidentally, 80% of the time, they forget where they were hidden, which God said to me is a bit of a message. Don't forget where they were hidden. And how do you know where they were hidden? Because you pass on the knowledge from generation to generation. It's important to remember where God has stored treasure and resources for us. So we're intentionally in this series looking back at what God has said to us in recent years. What does this look like in practice? And Sonny's amazing talk last week. Thanks for the intimidation, Sonny. Where he mentioned, You know, how do we do this? What is digging wells? It's a metaphor. What does it mean? And we've just started. This is just the beginning of unpacking what this looks like. It means intimacy with God. It means building altars, places and times in our individual and corporate church life where we regularly connect with God. And I reflected on that a bit and thought, we've sort of let go of thinking about times and places in Christian life. You know, denominational Christian worship used to be very much about times, places and seasons. And in being led by the Spirit and moving into a new generation of what God's doing, we've kind of let go of that as maybe being a bit old school. But actually, it occurred to me that you know, that's a bit of a baby out with the bathwater thing. I think actually there's a lot to do with times and seasons and places, because God has made us temporal, i.e. time-bound and place-bound people. He's made us physical. So basically, we can't always be fluid about everything. If Andy and I were completely fluid about our diary, we'd never get anywhere, and we'd never hit any appointment. You have to put important stuff in a time and place, don't you? Or it doesn't get done. So that's what God said to me about that bit, about building altars. And actually, he also brought to my mind that how did God know something had gone wrong in the Garden of Eden? Because he turned up at the regular meeting spot at the regular time, and Adam wasn't there. So they always met and chatted at that time. And God knew he would find him, so he turned up. So I think it's actually quite important, this idea that Sonny said about altars of time and place to meet with God. And in the next talk, you will learn about the new well that was dug and accepted, and that immediately after that success, the first thing Isaac did was revisit the altar, i.e. the meeting place with God, that his father Abraham had built. He went, once he'd found where he was meant to be, he went to the place where he knew God would communicate. In his very helpful outline of the talks, Andy suggested questions and things to look at, and I kind of stuck with them because it worked for me. So looking again at my verses, what was the motive for the quarrelling between these groups? And it was both earthly and spiritual resistance to what God was doing. Earthly, I think we've talked about in previous weeks, possession of wells in a desert land, as you move further and further from the shore and the plain where the rivers disgorge, there's no water. So possession of productive and habitable land meant wealth and power. The extent of your influence and control in those days was pretty much limited by how far your resources would literally stretch, how far you could walk, and whether you could get water on the way. You couldn't go beyond that. So access to water was heavily contested and protected. There was no surface water away from the coast. You had to dig down and then secure your access to it. So it was about control, power, where you could safely live. Also, Genesis suggests in the verse I read, the passage I put up at the beginning, which had some verses above it, it suggests that the Philistines were also jealous of Isaac's wealth and possessions and becoming fearful of him. He was, oh my goodness, he's expanding, he's a threat. Because again, land in those days could only support so many people. We found that when Abraham and Lot separated, didn't we? Somewhere else in Genesis. And also, I think they were fearful of this new tribe. Later on in Joshua's day, Rahab of Jericho says the Canaanites had always been afraid of the Israelites. Not just because of their numbers by then, but also because they recognized they had a very powerful God who'd done great miracles for them. And we'll get onto that aspect of spiritual authorities and their territorial powers in just a minute. But that story of Rahab's in, for the sake of the tape, Joshua 2, verses 9 and 10. So the Philistines reacted by banishing the Israelites from the best land by the sea and pushing Isaac further west and inland to a less productive region by literally blocking every attempt he made to settle, by blocking the well he dug. Presumably, eventually, they thought he was far enough away to not be a threat to them and probably wouldn't thrive because there wasn't enough water. So that's the earthly reason. Spiritually, there was a reason why they were quarrelling as well and pushing him away. The Old Testament world was very spiritually aware. Andy and I learnt so much about that when we went up to that thing at the British Museum that we've spoken about. We think of them as being primitive and superstitious and not really, you know, they didn't have our kind of intellect and science. Actually, we need to recognise they were far more aware of spiritual powers and heavenly authorities than we are. Our sophistication in the West and reliance on our intellect, aka our own understanding, has made us spiritually ignorant often of the battles we are in. The Philistines knew, didn't even know, it was just part of their worldview, it was part of their understanding that behind earthly powers, situations and circumstances and places were spiritual powers and authorities. Isaac and his tribe, with their strained and terrifying God, were trying to invade their physical realm, but also the realm of their God. They needed and were compelled by their gods to fight this. They couldn't just let that, you know, it was a territorial spiritual invasion to have this strange people and strange God plonk himself in the middle of them. They had to get rid of him. They had to do that. I think we learned in the British Museum and various talks, and I know some of you are coming on it, about the importance of understanding the culture of the Old Testament. And it's not just then, but even now, I think we are extremely ignorant, and I'm sure our African friends here will agree, of the kind of constraints and what it's like when you get away from urbanised areas. You know, even today, if you're in a desert, if you're in Afghanistan or the Far East or the Middle East, you can't go far if you can't get there. And even in recent times, great leaders made this miscalculation at their peril. Napoleon tried to invade Russia, having no idea how far it was, really, and how he would supply that distance from back there. Because he sure as heck wasn't going to get any supply from the Russians, was he? He was invading them. So we forget there's no that distance and resources makes a huge difference to what you can actually do. So we need to think ourselves into that world. The wells were very important. They were significant in an earthly sense, a practical sense, and very significant in a spiritual sense because it meant someone was settling. What was the response of Isaac and his servants? Now, this was the one that initially made me throw up my hands in horror and say to Andy, what on earth are you giving this to me for? Because I couldn't get it. They were so gracious, not quarrelsome. Isaac just accepted it. Why didn't they mind more? That was a bit I had to kind of ruminate on. And what I felt God showed me was that was faith. That was faith. That was his identity. Isaac knew that God had promised his father a great inheritance in this land. And so he trusted that God would provide and direct him, show him where that was, and he would end up in the right place. And he actually used the local response on the ground as part of that guidance for God, from God. So when he digs wells and he's not allowed to stay there, he takes this as a sign. Okay, not here then. You know, why fight it? Not here then. Move on. Dig another one. Oh, not here either. We'll get there. God's promised. I remember Bill Johnson in Bethel Church, America, says, where God calls, he always provides. So if you're not being provided for, maybe you're not where you should be. Today, we speak of God opening doors because there's a passage in the New Testament about Paul being directed by opening and closing doors. In those days, it was digging and unstopping wells. If God has closed a door or stopped a well or told you not to settle here or do this thing, and you're sure that's what he's saying, then why argue about it? There's no point. So Isaac basically just smiled and waved, as my sister often says, smile and wave, continued to move on and dig wells until God blessed one by indicating through the absence of quarrelling that this was the place. So Isaac's response came out of his faith in God and his identity of child as a child of promise and provision. We are children of promise and provision. Do we respond like this to God's direction and to the challenges in our life? How does quarrel and disunity affect us in TCF, block our progress? And I've said straight away, I realised that disunity, internal division and disagreement, is not the same as external opposition, which essentially is what Isaac was facing at this point. And it's clear to me in the Bible that God treated these very differently. He makes it very clear that he desires and blesses unity among his people. At the very least, where there isn't that, we will not experience the blessing that he promises. But if the internal disunity also leads to rebellion to his authorised leaders and opposition to his plans, it was punished ruthlessly. Those of you who know your Old Testament can think of so many examples. I was kind of overwhelmed with examples, but I've given Numbers 12, verses 1 to 3. People were, you know, Miriam got leprosy when she opposed. People were put to death for opposing. Plague came on them for opposing. So internal disunity and rebellion are very stamped on by God. External opposition and threat were a different matter. And I noted that God actually told his people to ask him in each and every circumstance what the response should be. There was no formula. And in 1 Chronicles 14, verse 8 to 16, there's a very telling example of this. So Joshua goes into battle against, the old foe, the Philistines. And there are two battles, and he's told to do two completely different things. He always consults with God, which is really important. The first time he consults God and God says, do this. The second time he consults God and God says, do something completely different. So there is no formula. We need to consult. God is our commander and sovereign. We need to consult him about our tactics and our battle plans. Even the best and wisest leaders in the Old Testament knew and did this. And those that did it well had outstanding victories, David and Moses, and those who did not failed, Saul and most of the later kings. Interestingly, Joshua consulted the Lord on every occasion but one. And on the one occasion when he failed, in Joshua 9, the story of the Gibeonite deception, he was completely misled, and it led to repercussions that affected the nation of Israel for hundreds of years, because they made a treaty with a group that they should have wiped out, and that group continued to literally be a thorn in their side for hundreds of years. So we should always seek guidance from God on which battles to pick and how to fight them. If he wants us to engage, he will give the victory. If he does not, then giving our time and attention to it is futile. We will just wear ourselves out, waste time, and lose focus getting involved in arguments. By the way, as we all know, timing is also very important to God. So although Isaac didn't respond to the Philistines picking a fight then. In David's day, excuse me, God made it very clear that Israel was to eradicate them from the land. That's in 2 Samuel 5, verse 22 to 25. And he did. So timing matters. It's not just should I do this battle, is it? Is it the time for this battle? What strategies do we have for avoiding disunity within TCF and with other churches? I mulled over this for some time, and what came to me were that we should put off and put on. God led me to Ephesians 4, which I will not read, but the whole of Ephesians 4 is about choosing, deciding how we speak and how we act, and not being led by our often distorted feelings. We're human beings. We can build up a real head of energy and emotion about stuff and 2 years later think, what was that about? Even ourselves. We need to allow our heads to rule. We need to put on our identity in God and seek his guidance when we come up against opposition. We can be challenged or knocked off course by wanderers and people who drift up and give us different words and things. We don't need to defend our God or his purposes. He can do that. We need to know our identity as his children and follow him. So we need to put on all aspects of godly living. And we should put off, most definitely put off, having a quarrelsome attitude. Being quick to take an offence. This comes, I would suggest, from pride in ourself and my understanding, and which we then feel the need to defend. We need to be intentional about avoiding even the slightest criticism and bickering, and set our minds to avoid petty squabbles, because they easily escalate. It starts as a little thing and becomes a big thing. And there is a word here, there are two words here, 1 Corinthians 1 verse 10 and 1 Peter 3 verse 8, which I've asked Andy to read.
I appeal to you, brothers and sisters, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you agree with one another in what you say, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly united in mind and thought. 1 Peter 3, 8. Finally, all of you be like-minded, be sympathetic, love one another, be compassionate and humble.
Thanks. Having been in TCF for over 40 years now, I've experienced a few of the episodes of quarrelling, internal and external. And my observation, just my observation, guys, is that over this time, our leaders, who have been the same and different from what we have now, have chosen not to react to accusations and arguments, or even correct untruths unless really necessary. They have largely left their own reputation and that of this fellowship to God. Whilst difficult and irritating at the time, not to defend yourself, and I'd have to tell you that as a leader's wife, I can still grind my teeth occasionally when I hear repeated distorted accounts of what happened years ago. You think, it really wasn't like that. But if you're not going to defend yourself, generally the facts don't get out, do they? But with maturity myself, I'm older and wiser now, I can see that in time, much criticism and challenge withers and dies, because it had no substance in the first place. All those who want a quarrel and want to constantly debate and want a response, they get tired of not getting that and they choose to leave. You save a lot of time and energy if you don't pick up the bones of every little issue. The late Queen was very wise in this way. If you remember, she said, never complain, never explain, stay out of squabbling. And we are heavenly royalty. Someone said that to us many years ago. We are heavenly royalty. We should stay out of squabbles, stay out of politics. You can focus on God if you're not dealing with that stuff. Are we aware of the spiritual causes behind what's going on? Well, a lot more so than we were, I think, like 10 or 20 years ago. Probably not as much as Isaac and the ancient peoples, but I think we're learning. One thing I reflected was that the tendency towards quarrelsomeness is actually all-pervasive in the world today, isn't it? And especially Western society, and is fueled by social media. Everyone can share their opinion instantly and then quarrel with those who inevitably hold a different view, because we're all different. The debate is not face-to-face with the live person, so rules of politeness and restraint don't seem to apply. And these attitudes now are spilling over into live relationships. So I think if we, rather than just saying, oh, I don't do any, I'm not interested in that, I'm not going to watch, I'm not going to be on Facebook, whatever. I do think we need to be wise, even if we choose not to do it, see what is going on in our world. Everybody is picking a fight with someone else, and it's getting more and more minor. So the people who previously walked together because they had, broadly speaking, similar issues of diversity, and now attacking each other. What is this about, people? What is this about? This, I believe, is a tactic stirred up by the enemy to keep mankind disunited, occupied, running around in unproductive circles and fighting each other. It's an attack on God's design for unity and harmony among his people. So we need to be really careful it does not infect the church. We need to be wise and spot it. It will be so easy for bits of tittle-tattle and, you know, behind-the-scenes social media-y stuff to undermine church life. We need to be wise, guys. And not quick to take offence. That's Titus 3, verse 9 to 10 in the Message. And Andy's got that because it sounds really good.
Stay away from mindless, pointless quarrelling over genealogies and fine print in the law code. It gets you nowhere. Warn a quarrelsome person once or twice, but then be done with him. It's obvious that such a person, out of line, rebellious against God, by persisting in divisiveness, he cuts himself off.
Yeah, so be alert to provocation to squabbling. The enemy will use it. And don't forget, he can even use things that seem right. For example, God himself calls us to speak out against cruelty and injustice. But does this mean he wants you to be his campaign scream warrior for some issue or other? Cat rescue, veganism or whatever. You know, even things that are good in themselves, you need to ask God, is this what you want me to be doing? Or do you want me to be, you know, somewhere else? Use your spiritual awareness to avoid being stuck into needless quarrels. So, to summarise, how to avoid quarrelling and how to respond when it breaks out. This is just a few I plonked down. Mark Birch Machen mentioned this one. Ask yourself, when you're faced with something, before you type that message, is this my good idea or God's idea? Might be both. Only put your effort into the latter. Resolve to know God's word and his ways well, as they will guide you. Intentionally set aside times and places where you meet him, and so that you get to know his ways and his word. Be on your guard against a spirit of quarrelling and divisiveness. That kind of, you have to get your mind to control your responses, don't you? Because somebody says something you disagree strongly with, or that is an attack on you, and it just comes up, doesn't it? This feeling like, that you've got to respond. You know, use the Holy Spirit to control your mind to think, what should my response to this be? Be spiritually discerning of what's going on in the heavenly places. Who's behind this? this that I see in front of me, who's behind this? Know your identity as a believer, a saved follower of Jesus Christ. What would Jesus do? A hackneyed old phrase that we all laughed about, that was in fashion and then wasn't, is actually not a bad checklist. And all this applies to us both as individuals and as a community. Our leaders do this for us as a community. We take responsibility for doing it for ourselves as individuals. And my last little aside, which isn't up there, is it really did impact on me that Isaac was only able to do all of that because he had the knowledge, and the knowledge had been passed on to him. It's really important that we pass on the knowledge of who God is and what he's done to our biological children, but also to new believers in the faith. Passing the baton in a relay race is absolutely vital. It's the place where the race is usually lost if the baton is fumbled or dropped. And God makes it really clear throughout the Old Testament, we have a responsibility to pass on the knowledge and worship of him to the next generation. Sadly, in the Old Testament, the Israelites mostly failed to do that. Thank you.